and a big welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste, your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we'll have a preview of the film The Super Salmon with guest Ryan Peterson. Beth McKibben, Margaret O'Neill, and Tamara Rowcroft will be here to talk about this evening's public meeting on the draft Juno Housing Action Plan. Local artist Tyus Schaub will highlight her art at First Friday and the Juno Artist Gallery. In a conversation with Petersburg artist Pia Riley about her First Friday show at Annie Kales. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno.
This is National Native News. I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Friends and family of a Navajo woman are expressing dismay over her shooting death by police in Winslow, Arizona. An officer shot 27-year-old L'Oreal Sinjini after police say she brandished a weapon that, in their words, presented a sustainable threat to the officer as he attempted to take her into custody. Police confirm family reports that Sinjini was holding a pair of scissors. The incident began when a convenience store called in a shoplifting complaint. A struggle started after police confronted Sinjini, who matched the description of the alleged shoplifter. Family members and others took to social media and news outlets to complain of what they say is an overreaction by police. State public safety officials are investigating, and the officer is on routine administrative leave following the shooting. A 12-year-old First Nations boy in Ontario recently ran more than 20 miles a day for 4 days. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he's raising money and awareness for the children of missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
Taylan Kitnosway is a member of the Walpole Island First Nation in southwestern Ontario. He began his journey at an Algonquin community in Quebec about 80 miles north of Ottawa. But there was symbolism to the departure and endpoints of the run. Where he began is also where two First Nations women disappeared in 2008, and where Kitnosway finished his run was the spot in Gatineau Park, where another First Nations woman was found dead in December of 2006. Kitnosway says the run means more to him than just helping the children of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
Running for them is something that has really helped me grow up and grow into be like a man and from what I used to be.
Official estimates from police say 1,200 Indigenous women and girls in Canada have disappeared or been murdered since 1980, but unofficial estimates put the numbers much higher, and the Canadian government is in the process of launching a national inquiry into the issue. As for Kitnosway, his efforts have not ended. He says his mission is to plan similar walks over the next 2 years. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
FEMA is offering disaster training for the first time specifically for tribal emergency personnel. All but a handful of the 165 students at the Center for Disaster Preparedness in Anniston, Alabama, were from 46 tribal nations in 18 states. As KNBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, students called the FEMA training, especially the hands-on drills, valuable.
During one drill held at a former hospital used just for training, dozens of volunteers wore makeup showing minor scrapes, wounds, and serious injuries. One volunteer, a double amputee in real life, had the stumps of his legs made up to look like mangled limbs, spurting fake blood. A student tightened tourniquets. Later, Comanche police officer Kieran Daly said he had tried out the latest in hazmat suits, complete with breathing apparatus, during chemical, ordnance, biological, and radiological training. He says the exercise included handling of actual deadly nerve agents, an experience he says will help him in the field.
Now, if I run into it, I can say, okay, well, look, I've already got the training and the materials to be able to protect myself, but now I won't be so freaked out, you know. So to know that, hey, I can actually survive being in an environment all protected like this. And normally, you don't get that. There's nothing like this out there. And honestly, I think there should be more training like this.
Tribal liaison David Hall says he put together Tribal Training Week to help meet tribal needs for emergency response training. It took parts of 2 years to coordinate this one. He's already working to organize another. The Center for Disaster Preparedness offers emergency response training in areas such as medical care, fire service, law enforcement, and communications, all at no cost to the participants. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by VisionMaker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. On February 20th, VisionMaker Media celebrates 40 years of advancing Native culture, heritage, wisdom, sacred stories, and the storyteller. More at visionmakermedia.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Ryan Peterson, an Alaska filmmaker. And Rose, I don't know your last name.
Marie Rose.
I thought you were just Rose.
I'm just Rose.
All right. Well, Marie Rose, welcome. And Marie is with Trout Unlimited, and they're the sponsoring organization. And Ryan, you're here because you have a fairly new movie called The Super Salmon, and it's being there's a movie screening of this film this evening, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's doors open at 6:30. The film will be at 7, and this is downtown at the Rockwell Ballroom. So
yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And you know, the salmon, you think about Alaska, it's such a central player storyline on many, many levels, the salmon. And in this case, in this film, you've done a remarkable thing. You've taken the journey of an individual salmon to tell a bigger story, a broader story. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's right. So the story is, get into some of the specifics later, but it's basically about this river, the Susitna, which is the 15th biggest river in the United States. It drains the entire Alaska Range, which is the biggest, tallest mountain range on the continent. And it's about also the people who live along that river and who live with it and from it and literally on it. But it's also about this one particular fish that was, you know, kind of the background context here is that the state has proposed this hydroelectric dam on the Susitna River, and that's kind of forced attention onto it that has not been there before to the extent that it is now. And it's kind of interesting because that river is such a big, literally and figuratively, it's a big, big Alaskan river. And anyway, so they were doing these studies, these pre-feasibility scientific studies of the watershed, ecological studies, and they put a radio tag in this one salmon. And, you know, so now they're able to track this fish, right? So not only with telemetry, like they'll go out in helicopters or airplanes and, you know, beep, 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 and pick it up and make a mark of where it is in the watershed, but then also they'll have sensors on either side of the river, and when the salmon swims through this beam, it marks it as well. And so they could get down to very specific location levels. They could track what this fish did. And I was trying to figure out how to tell this story because, I mean, just a lot of Alaskan media attention on rivers and fish, and there's a lot of films about, you know, big projects. And dams aren't particularly a sexy subject. A bunch of concrete, a big wall is kind of hard to make universally interesting. But when I read the scientific report on what this fish did, it was so incredible and really almost unbelievable in the sense that no fish had been documented to do what it did. So that was kind of my hook that got my attention, and I thought it would get others too.
And then you could see in your head a film.
Totally.
A story. So tell us about, what did you go do? I mean, you went out and you created this film that's going to be seen here in Juneau this evening. So
yeah, so like I said, the Susitna is this major, major watershed.
And just for Southeast people, just place it for us on the map.
Okay, so you know where Anchorage is, the terminus where it comes into Cook Inlet is just across Cook Inlet from Anchorage. It's like 20-some miles straight line from Anchorage. But the vast majority of this watershed is remote. It crosses the Parks Highway in one place, just north of Talkeetna, and it crosses the Denali Highway in another place near Paxson, so north of Glen Allen a ways. Excuse me. And apart from that, it's completely wild. I mean, very few people even live up to the edge of it. You see it if you take off from Lake Hood. If anyone's ever kind of flown up and gone fishing on Lake Creek or the Deschka River or Willow Creek or Montana Creek, you get in the air and it's the dominant kind of water feature once you cross over Cook Inlet from Anchorage. But despite all that, it's the most visited, the most hunted, the most fished, the most recreated upon river in the entire state in terms of, you know, person use days. That includes, you know, everything from commercial fishing to hunting, subsistence and sport hunting and fishing for all that means. There are a lot of sport fishing lodges in the industry, a lot of just straight tourism. You know, anybody who goes from Anchorage to Denali Park goes through the Susitna watershed. But despite all of that, you know, it just doesn't have the cultural cachet that a river, say, like the Kenai does, or even these rivers that we have down here, the Taku and such. Those almost have more name recognition and kind of cultural familiarity than the Susitna does. And so that kind of struck me as something that I wanted people to understand how much they knew the Susitna as we're sort of contemplating these projects that could maybe change things. You know, like the Iditarod crosses the Susitna, for instance.
So for people who go tonight to see this film, and you the vehicle of a salmon being kind of the main character in the story, what are they going to see? Without giving away the film, I mean, what's the story that you tell?
Right, so I got a little sidetracked there, but the point of it, the story is I wanted to show the entire river, and this salmon is kind of a character that will allow me to do that while telling a story, right? So the salmon comes out of the ocean into the lower river, and you can show the lower river, the delta, and it continues past the confluences of all these very famous tributaries, and each of them going up through there, and then he gets to Talkeetna, and he goes beyond that, and there's Devil's Canyon, which has the highest standing waves in the world. You talk to kayakers, and that's like the Everest of whitewater is Devil's Canyon on the Susitna. And then he gets into the upper watershed. And upstream of the Denali Highway, to my knowledge, it hasn't hardly ever, if ever, been filmed kind of properly. And so the salmon was just kind of a vehicle, literally and figuratively, to show the entire watershed, which is something that not everyone's seen.
And then there's a lot of stories that spill out from that journey. I mean, there's a lot of individual kind of,
right.
I mean, it's the lay of the land, but it's the economics of the land, it's the culture of the land, there's the history of the land. So all of those components are wrapped up in your film, I believe. And how did you do it? I mean, physically, literally. I mean, was this easy to do? Was this super challenging to do? You're in some wild and remote places, and you're dragging around film equipment and technology to make this thing work.
Yeah.
I mean, the clips I saw, it looks beautiful. So there's a quality here that you captured.
Well, I got lucky. I met this guy, Mike Wood, who lives with his wife, Molly, right on the river, off-grid, north of Talkeetna. And the initial impetus for this film, I didn't even know it would be a film, but I wanted to go install some time-lapse cameras that I eventually did that shot one photo every 30 minutes for 2 years, if for no other reason at that time than to have a physical documentation of what the river looks like in its pre-dam flow regime and state. And in trying to find places to put those cameras, I got connected with this guy, Mike Wood. And we have a mutual friend in Anchorage. And I called him up and I was like, hey, man, I know you're from Talkeetna. I'm trying to find someone that can show me around on the river. And he's like, you need to talk to Mike Wood. I was like, okay. He goes, he's kind of a wilderness ninja. And I was like, all right, whatever that means, but it sounds good. And it turns out to be true. This guy he's really just a charismatic guy, really smart, really funny, and very much in love in a very literal sense with the river that he lives on. And so kind of with his help, I was able to navigate the wilderness aspects of the filmmaking process. But then also, once people found out I was making this film, filmmaker friends of mine, a lot of footage and help came just pouring in, like this team did a full descent from the glacier source to Cook Inlet in pack rafts, and they filmed along the way and just gave that footage knowing that I was working on this. Another group had access to like a $15,000 a day Cineflex camera to fly as part of a film they are working on the Alaska Range, but they flew a few days over the Susitna out of Talkeetna and gave me that footage. So there's, you know, there's at the end of the day, there's everything from Hollywood level cinematography to stuff I shot on my iPhone when nothing else was handy.
Mm-hmm. Very good. We've been listening to Ryan Peterson, an Alaska filmmaker, talking about his movie, The Super Salmon. It's going to be screened here in Juneau this evening, downtown at the Rockwell Ballroom. The doors open at 6:30. The film begins at 7. Before we wrap it up here, anything else, just for people who are thinking, oh, that sounds interesting, anything you want to add to the conversation just to kind of hook them on why they might want to?
I very much, this film was made not, you know, it's not just a river about fish or about salmon or about conservation or about Alaska's future or all of those factor in, but it's a story that I've tried to tell so anyone could watch it without having any familiarity with this and be literally entertained. I mean, it's funny, and it tells a story that stands alone independent of all these kind of outside factors that are hot topic issues in Alaska these days. It's just kind of has a light tone to it. And I was shocked that we've screened it a few times in Talkeetna, Anchorage, and Palmer, and afterwards kids, parents of little kids come up to me and say, oh, she loved it, he loved it. And that's...
That must have made you feel good.
Totally, but it's unexpected. And, you know, there's like some cartoon stuff, some animation involved in it. They respond to that, but it's a very simple story, and it's told with heart, and... that probably explains a lot of it. Kids react to that, and hopefully everyone else will too.
Ryan Peterson, congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Good luck with the screening this evening in Rose and Trout Unlimited. Thank you for sponsoring it. Thanks for coming in.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 30th of March, 2016. It was on this day, 1867, the United States agreed to purchase Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million. 1858, on this day, in Philadelphia, a man named Hyman Lippmann patented the first pencil with an eraser attached. It was an American phenomenon. Most European pencils are still without erasers. Pencils which are hexagonal in shape to keep them from rolling off the table. Single pencil can write about 45,000 words. And if you make a mistake, thanks to Hyman Lippmann, you have an eraser right there. It's the birthday of the playwright Sean O'Casey, born in Dublin, 1880, author of many plays, including The Shadow of a Gunman, story of a poor poet mistaken for an Irish Republican Army fighter, who decides to go along with it since it's getting him some attention from a pretty woman. It was part of his Dublin trilogy, which included Juno and the Paycock and The Plough and the Stars. It's the birthday of the man who said, to do good work, one must eat well, be well housed, have one's fling from time to time, smoke one's pipe, and drink one's coffee in peace. Vincent van Gogh, born in Groot Zundert, Holland, in 1853. Never had any formal training in art. He taught himself to draw, moved to Paris, then to the south of France, began painting sunflowers, committed himself to an asylum. 1888, he suffered from manic depression, but he was working at an incredible pace during all this time, made his famous painting Starry Night. 2 years later, he left the asylum. He was still painting at a frenetic pace, turning out a painting almost daily. And one July afternoon, 1890, he shot himself, dying of the wound 2 days later. Here's a poem for today by Charles Bukowski, Notes Upon a Hot Streak. I have been driving to the racetrack for 30 years now. In some of the worst junk cars imaginable, I have outlived most of the parking lot attendants. But now as I drive up in a new BMW, some of them remember me from the old days. "Hey, champ," they say, "how's it going?" "It's going good," I tell them. "Got a good one for me, champ?" they ask. I wink and drive on in. They think I'm making it at the races. They think I have solved the ponies. "Hey, champ, who was that young girl you were with the other day?" I drive on in. I play the horses like other men play chess. Make the proper moves and make them well. And lately, after all these years, I have begun to win. And I leave with little bundles of money each day. It's a very odd feeling, but I accept it. Use valet parking to the clubhouse. It is a lovable comedy, both the writing and the betting. They are letting me win for this moment. But the attendants seem to think that I know some secret. "You're looking good, champ. Just give me one good one, and I won't bother you anymore." I smile and drive on in. Poem by Charles Bukowski, Notes Upon a Hot Streak, from Dangling in the Tournifortia, published by Black Sparrow Press and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games. Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This first Friday, come join the Alaska Photographic Arts Association for their 16th annual spring show. Enjoy the work of close to 20 local photographers in a show that includes landscapes, portraits, nature photography, and more. The show will be up throughout the month of April at the KTOO building. There will be an opening reception this Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio three women who are involved or integral in the development of the draft Juneau Housing Action Plan. And there's a public meeting this evening and tomorrow evening. But first, I want to make sure you guys get introduced properly. And I don't know your titles. So, Margaret, why don't we start with you?
My name's Margaret O'Neill. My day job is working for the Juneau Economic Development Council. I am the CFO there and also run some of our business programs, business counseling in our loan program, and I am the newly elected chair of the Juneau Affordable Housing Commission.
I'm Beth McKibben. I'm the planning manager for the Community Development Department at the City and Borough of Juneau, and I'm one of the staff liaisons to the Affordable Housing Commission.
And I'm Tamara Rowcroft. My day job is executive director of Alaska Housing Development Corporation, and I'm the former chair of the Affordable Housing Commission.
So this evening at from 6 to 8 p.m. at 360, the studio here in the KTOO building, you're putting on a public meeting to, I assume, have this kind of presented, the draft presented, and I'm assuming there's an audience role here where you're hoping to get questions or have some kind of interaction.
Sure.
So why don't you just tell us about this evening's event?
Okay, well, it's kind of a different animal than a lot of the public meetings because it has a specific public purpose. This is a report that actually belongs to the City and Borough of Juneau, and our goal from the Affordable Housing Commission is to get it adopted as a component of the Juneau Comprehensive Plan. It's a real plan about, you know, developing homes and increasing our inventory in Juneau. Beth, why don't you talk about the process, the public part of the process?
Well, for tonight's meeting, we'll have a brief overview of the plan and the key findings of the plan, and then have the audience break out into small groups and talk about some of the specific recommendations and gather some feedback from them. One of the goals is also to roll it out and educate the community about the plan in addition to getting their comments and feedback and what they think about some of the ideas for implementation. As we developed the plan, we hired consultants from Virginia. They're specialists in housing, and we worked with them. They worked with the Affordable Housing Commission as their steering committee in guiding the process. They came to Juneau and met with several focus groups that included developers, housing providers, finance people, real estate people, those kinds of things as they developed the plan. And then they came back and held a public meeting to present some of their findings. They met with the Affordable Housing Commission and members of the public and went through some of those things as well as gathering more feedback, which resulted in this plan that we have out for public review right now. And then, as Margaret had mentioned, if it's going to be, one of the goals is that it's adopted as part of the comprehensive plan, which means it will have hearings in front of the Planning Commission as well as the Assembly before it's formally adopted.
So this is a big undertaking.
It's our big deal. I mean, this is one of the major goals that we've had for a couple of years, and Tamara and Beth, you know, both did a huge amount of work, and I really want to thank them for their leadership in this. And Beth was the project manager, worked with the consultants. We all worked on the RFP, and Tamara did a lot of the legwork in the community, setting up the stakeholder meetings and making sure that they were talking to the right people. And it is, you know, once the plan gets adopted in the comprehensive plan, you know, it still could be just a plan on the shelf unless there's the will and the public support and the commitment of resources to do the implementation. And we're looking at new thinking, and why don't you talk about that, Tamara?
Well, yeah, what we really want to do is we want to have new thinking about the housing issue. We want to really look for new strategies, and we've come up with some ideas for new strategies. But housing's always been an issue in this community. I've lived here off and on since I was in the second grade, and it's always been an issue. It was an issue when I first moved here with my family. It was an issue with my family, my young family, when I came back here as a young adult, and it's now an issue for my kids. And I think it'll probably be an issue for my grandkids. So really, we want to see some changes, and we want to move forward on making housing part of a conversation that we have every day about how we can move housing forward in our community. And there's a lot of areas that we think we can really see improvement.
Is this the first time there's been one of these plans developed and implemented?
You mean ever in the world?
No. Here in Juneau. I mean, you were just referencing, yeah, in your lifetime, you've said this has always been an issue.
I believe this is probably going to be the first dynamic housing action plan in the state of Alaska. We've had a lot of needs assessments. We've done several of those ourselves. But in terms of having a roadmap for actually changing what housing looks like in our community, I don't think that any of the other communities have done that. All three of us were just in February up at the Governor's Housing Summit, and people kept coming up to us and asking us about the cool things that we were doing in Juneau, but yet we still have this problem.
Yeah.
We still have housing inventory that's degrading. You can drive around town, and you can see all these homes that are kind of in bad shape, and yet it's still not affordable for quite a few of the people who live here and for our workforce. And it is a real barrier. It's a curb against economic growth, and businesses can't expand if they don't have a growing population to buy their goods and services for businesses that support the community. The export businesses can't really expand if they can't get a workforce that can allow them to have growth because their workers can't find a place to live. And there's anecdote after anecdote about businesses that, you know, that have faced those problems. They've brought employees up here that are totally qualified and really excited about living in Alaska, and then they turn around and leave when they look at what we have to supply for housing.
So what, all these years of not really having a plan, what led to this effort coming together and actually producing something? You're on the verge of actually producing this plan, or you're getting close to it. So what, something happened here to make the community say, we got to do this?
That's what they say about instant success. You know, it's like someone's an overnight success when they've been toiling away for dozens and dozens of years. How long have you been on the Affordable Housing Commission?
Gosh, since its inception, which I guess time goes so quickly, but I
think, 6 years or
and then
I think 2007.
Yeah, 2007. So, yeah. But I was actually on a task force that the city had set up in the 1990s because my job, my day job, is with housing. We do housing development. We have a portfolio of affordable housing that the nonprofit that I work for, Alaska Housing Development Corporation, has developed and manages here in town. And so I got asked to sit on a task force in the 90s that talked about the need for more affordable housing options in the community. And that task force, I think we were together for a year and a half or 2 years. And a lot of good came out of that process. There was a little spur of development of affordable housing at that time using some really specific kinds of financing tools that were new to the state from the federal government. But after that time, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on having a housing program or really there wasn't a lot of dialogue. And I think what happened that was different this time is that a group of business owners and citizens and different folks in the community, you know, all got together and started having conversation about how important housing is and why housing really needs, really we need to have a focus on it. We really need to come up with some tools to get our work on our housing issues in the community. And so out of that, the Housing Commission was born through the city, was established, and it's now permanently established, and it's a very dynamic group of people from the community, builders, nonprofit sector, attorneys, you name it. We've got a whole group of people on there, and we meet monthly, and we've really been trying to wrap our heads around what is it that needs to be done differently, and what are some of the ideas and strategies that we can adopt in our community to actually get housing moving. And we're starting to see already results. There have been positive changes. There has the housing meter, the needle on the housing meter is going in the right, has been going in the right direction for a couple of years, which is great. And we just want to continue to see that happen.
So you have this public meeting tonight here at 360 in the K2 building starting at 6 p.m. And then I think you have one tomorrow night as well, right, at the Mendenhall Library?
Tomorrow night at the Valley Library at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. So, and then what?
To your question, you know, the city's been doing a lot of different things. It's been doing things, you know, densifying neighborhoods,
right,
using zoning. They've expanded infrastructure, water and sewer. There have been height increases downtown. We have the Juno Affordable Housing Fund, which we've used to spur some novel kinds of pilot projects to get more home accessory apartments in the community. There's been a lot of work that's been done, but one of the real eye-openers to me when I was looking at the Housing Action Plan was just this idea that just more of what we've already got isn't going to get it for us because we don't have the land to develop in the same way we did when we had in the early 80s when most of the homes were built in the valley and so forth. And so we're going to have to look at much more increased density than what we've had. We're going to have to look at mixed use. You know, every little commercial area is going to have housing in it. We need a lot more housing downtown. And when we're looking at redevelopment, and those are going to require some, it's going to have to be paid for by Juno. And it doesn't necessarily mean the city of Juno alone. You know, we're looking at public-private partnerships and ways to incentivize private investment, sort of mixes of carrots and sticks. And those things are all going to be in the recommendations that we're going to talk about tonight and actually dig into in detail. And we really feel like, you know, we want new thinking, new ways of doing business, and people are going to have to be a lot more flexible about what this community looks like for the betterment of everyone, so that our kids can come home, so that we can have workers, so that we can retire here, so that we can find places that are appropriate to live in, so that everybody's not just stuck in their split-level house and doesn't have a place to go. So what we're looking for is expanding choices for everyone. And I think that'll keep the property values high, but also reward homeowners and renters with a lot more value for the money that they're spending.
Well, I recognize we could talk a lot about this topic, but it might just be easier for people to know that they should come to the meeting tonight, because that's the forum you're presenting. You're creating a space for people to come and actually be a part of this and participate in this. And I assume it's an important part of the stakeholder process here is at key times opening it up to the public.
And absolutely. And don't forget there's another opportunity tomorrow as well.
Yeah, very good. Tamara Rowcroft, Beth McKibben, and Margaret O'Neill, thank you very much for coming in again this evening at 6 o'clock here at KTOO, a public meeting to discuss the draft Juneau Housing Action Plan, and a repeat tomorrow evening as well.
Right.
Out of the Valley. Go ahead, Tamara.
And there's a link on the CBJ website to a complete copy of the draft plan as well, and we'd love to have people submit comments as well. We're taking comments through May 2nd. With the closing on May 2nd. So if folks for some reason can't make tonight or tomorrow night, they can go to that and get a complete copy to read and let us know what their thoughts are. We'd really love to hear from
them. That link is right on in the middle of the homepage in the Hot Topics section. It's juneau.org.
Very good. Well, thank you all three for your work, for your commitment to this important issue in our community, and good luck with the rest of the process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a big welcome to Thais, Did I get that correct?
Yep.
Thais Shab. Thais is the featured artist at the Juno Artist Gallery. So, you know, First Friday is Friday, and
yes.
the month of April, I believe you will be the featured artist in the
Juno
Artist Gallery. So congratulations on that. And we'll, I know we'll, we will talk about the co-op in a bit, but first off, your art, what kind of art do you do?
I am a jewelry artist,
mm-hmm.
and I have been doing it, gosh, for probably 15 years or so. I've been a member of the Juno Artist Gallery for the last 10 years. I started out just doing regular, just beading necklaces and making earrings, and in recent years, I've sort of expanded to metal work, and I still do my regular beading using, you know, freshwater pearls, a lot of Swarovski crystals, gemstones of all sorts. And I started really kind of enjoying hammering on metal. Gets your aggressions out, or it's I don't know, there's just something about it. It's very satisfying taking metal and moving it and mm-hmm. bending it, and I've been really enjoying that recently. I'm starting to make rings, which is kind of new. I started about a year ago, but I've been working on quite a few of them. I'll have quite a few new ones out on Friday.
Yeah. So how does so you're dabbling in art, you're doing beading, and so how do you find yourself suddenly hammering on metals, and how do you learn, and how do you, are you just completely self-taught? Is that
I
the
am
nature
self-taught.
Of art?
Yes,
know?
I am self-taught. I actually, Rowan Law used to be a member of our gallery, and he did metal work, metal jewelry, and I took, after he left our gallery, I took a class from him. Occasionally he does a class in Juneau at the what's the name of the place downtown, just went out of my head. Anyway, I took a class from him and made a ring, and it was kind of fun. Got a little bit of instruction about it, but mostly I've just, you know, read up on books. You can learn so much on YouTube.
Yeah,
you can go on YouTube and see people do stuff, but mostly I don't like to read instructions, or, you know, I just kind of experiment. I'm a scientist by nature. I majored in biology, minored in chemistry, and so I kind of like the chemistry of it too. And I love rocks. I love the I just actually recently went to the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, and they have the coolest rocks from all over the world, and some of them are just raw that people, you know, collect, but then there's a lot of beads and all kinds of gemstones, and some of the necklaces I just recently made are from those gemstones that I bought while I was down there.
So, what kind of metals? And I mean, you mentioned a ring, you mentioned necklaces. Are there other kinds of jewelry that are also in the mix here? Or are we talking about a lot of small things? Are we talking about big things? I mean, give people a feel. So, for people who come Friday or during April to see your work.
I have, when it comes to like a necklace, I make big chunky necklaces. I also make delicate necklaces.
Mm-hmm.
I am really all over the map, and it kind of depends on my mood. At the bead show or the gem show in Tucson, I bought a lot of real small gemstones, and so I'm making some little ruby necklaces, and, you know, peridot and aquamarine, and those are gemstones I haven't used too much before because they're kind of expensive, but I found some small ones at a good price, and so I've got some very reasonably priced necklaces and earrings in that area. The chunkier stuff I got was some labradorite, which is a gemstone from it was first found in Labrador. It's found in other places in the world, but labradorite has this internal light that when light hits it a certain way, it all kinds of colors come out. In fact, there's a folklore that in Labrador, it's been used for centuries by the natives there, and they said that the northern lights were caught inside this rock, and when the sun hits it a certain way, you can see the northern lights play, and it really is like that. And I bought Labradorite before, but it was online, and you get it, and it's not very good. So I could pick it up and hold it myself and see, get the ones that were, that had better light and play. And so there'll be some of that. And that I actually did put a couple of pieces in just a couple of days ago, and I'm working tomorrow. I'll probably put some more out. And then Friday, you know, is the big opening.
And being the featured artist, what does that mean? I mean, there's like 12 artists there.
Actually 20,
yeah,
there's many, a whole, 23 artists.
So there's a whole lot of people involved with the gallery, yes. But when you're the featured artist, what does that mean?
It means that for First Friday, you are the featured artist. So you try to have some new stuff in that you haven't had before, so which I've been working on. One of my jobs at the gallery is to do the promotion for First Friday, and I've been doing that for quite a long time. And we didn't have an artist for April, and I didn't attend the March meeting. So since I wasn't there, they elected me to be the First Friday artist.
Nicely done, co-op.
and I have... I've been in the gallery for 10 years, and I haven't been a First Friday artist since I started. So that they kind of roped me into it. It was my turn. So I got roped into it. But it's fun. I enjoy, you know, people, and I like the tourists in the summer, and enjoy the locals coming in, and just encourage the locals to come. I will be there, but there will be other artists there as well. A lot of times we ask as many artists to come and, you know, kind of stand by their work, and so people can, mm-hmm. you know, have a, you know, some treats. We're known for having really good food at the Juno Artist Gallery during the gallery walks, and so we'll be set up at 4:30. It'll last till 7, at least as far as the food. I will be set up, you know, I get a little extra space as you walk into the gallery. There's a display of my jewelry that is. I will also have my normal displays, but I have a display that I get extra because I'm the featured artist for the month of April. So there's additional items there for people to look at as they come in.
So let's just take a minute, maybe two, just about the gallery. Just for people who are not familiar, this organization's been there since the mid-80s, is
yes,
that correct?
Yes,
yeah, so just give people a sense for how this works.
It started in 1985 kind of as a Christmas bazaar, and it was only seasonal. And then they started eventually, I'm not quite sure when it came to be a year-round, but it's been operating since 1985. It is owned by, you know, currently there's 23 of us. We all own it together. We have no employees. There's always one of the artists is on duty. Pay a small rent. It's $250 a month to have a space. But you also then, when you are working the gallery, we all take turns. When you work, you don't get paid in addition to that. But and the gallery keeps 15%, and which is a lot less than if you were to, you know, sell it outright. You know, it's usually many places take 50% or 40%. So it's a good way for especially new artists or artists that kind of want to just spend, you know, put in 4 to 8 hours a week, 8 in the summer, maybe less than that in the winter. And we're looking for new artists. We've had several people move. Several people just kind of had done it for a number of years and decided to, you know, take a break. It's not uncommon for artists to be with us for a few years and then they take a break and then they come back. But we've got several spaces, and the gallery works the best when we've got a full gallery. It doesn't look like it's empty because we fill it in with other artists, you know, art, but we do have spaces available. We're currently juring in a new artist, a new photographer, which I think he will probably get elected. That's in process. You do need to, there's an application process, and that's all described on our website, www.junoartistsgallery.com. Put an S after artists, artistsgallery.com. Anyway, and we can also, we have applications available to pick up at the gallery anytime. We're open, this time of year, 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday, 11 to 6. Come summer, it'll be 7 days a week, basically nine to nine. So.
Very good. Thais Shab, it's been a pleasure meeting you. Congratulations on your beautiful art and being the featured artist this month at the Juno Artist Gallery. First Friday kickoff is right around the corner,
right.
And your artwork will be featured throughout the month of April. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
This is Bird Note. Let's assume for a moment that you have a yard that a pair of robins has nested in for 12 years. You may be surprised to learn that it hasn't always been the same pair. Mortality rate is high in our familiar songbirds. For robins, it's around 50% each year once young birds have fledged. If a robin survives to midwinter, it lives an average of 1.7 years after that. The oldest robins in your yard might be about 6 years old, although one banded bird lived almost 14 years. So in a dozen years, you've probably had at least a half dozen robins of each sex involved in nesting. Robins, and most other migratory birds, don't maintain their pair bonds over winter, so they mate anew each spring. But if the same male and female return to the same territory, they're very likely to mate again. If the male has died, another male will likely take over the territory, and the living female may mate with him. Similarly, if the female has died, a new female will mate with the resident male. They may nest in the same shrub, if it's a favorable nesting spot, and to our eyes, it looks as if the same pair of robins has returned. To learn more, come to birdnote.org.
Join Sitka Fine Arts Camp and Sitka Sound Science Center this July for 2 weeks of exploration, inquiry, and adventure. Sitka Arts and Science Festival is a new summer program for adults that bring together the arts and sciences through intensive workshops, guided excursions, and accommodations on Sitka Fine Arts Camp's historic campus. These two sessions run from July 16th until the 23rd and July 23rd until the 30th. You can find more information at sitkafestival.org or 907-747-3085.
And featuring artists, First Friday, we continue with Pia Riley from Petersburg, who is in the studio, who's the featured artist at Annie Kales. Is it still called Annie Kales or is it just Kales? I kept seeing it written as Kales.
No, it's still Annie Kales.
It's still Annie Kales.
Yeah.
And that's Colleen Goldrich, who is the owner of Annie Kales. So welcome to you both. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Pia, so your beautiful art is going to be featured starting Friday, all month in the gallery there in the store. And for people who are not familiar with your art currently, what are you producing? What's your muse right now?
Most of the paintings that are here in Juno right now are watercolors. They're really I use a lot of pigments, so they're really forceful, they're strong in colors. So lots of florals, trees, fish, because I come from a fishing town. So I do a lot of borders on paintings, kind of painted in around them. That's kind of a signature, I think, for me. Yeah.
Watercolors, I think most people think of, you know, wispy, diffuse,
right,
soft, and you're saying it's something different.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always get the question, is this really watercolors? And so they're strong.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the themes of any particular reason why the themes you just expressed?
I don't know. I like those shapes, you know, the round and flowy shapes of nature, but they're very playful, I would say.
Lifelong artists? Have you always been, ever from early ages on up? And have you always been, I guess you're a professional artist in this case. You're selling your art. So have you always been a professional artist as well?
Well, I came to Juneau first in 1984 and lived here through 85. And I had just finished art school when I came here. But I lived on a boat, so I had to make really small paintings. And that's what I did here in Juneau.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now you're in Petersburg. So
I have been in Petersburg since 1986, so 30 years now.
And are you from this area originally?
No, I'm from Sweden.
Ah, Sweden and not Petersburg, very appropriate. So.
Right, right.
So you found yourself in Petersburg.
Scandinavian. Yes,
Very good. Mm-hmm. So Colleen, have you had Pia's work featured before in your store?
Well, not since I bought it. We're so excited to have Pia here, and it's just, she was one of the artists that I just went after in terms of trying to get a date with her right when we bought the gallery. So we're just thrilled that it has come to be time to do it. And Pia has shown there a couple of other times, but it's been before you.
And I had a show together.
Yeah,
we had a show
together the first time I met Pia, and that, I don't know when that was, maybe 2007 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, I think. Yeah.
At Annie Gill's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Colleen, when you're featuring an artist, I mean, your store is filled with art, right, of all kinds.
Yeah.
So, but when you're featuring an artist, what does that mean for the general public in terms of First Friday and through the month?
So what it means is that we have a very large exhibit of their work, basically, and we have a main feature wall, we call it, in the gallery. It's right in the middle of the store. And we showcase an artist for the month. So this month, Pia has brought 17 originals with her of varying shapes and sizes, and they are beautiful. I just feel so lucky that... we get to live with that art
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a beautiful, amazing amount of work, and it's really exciting to look at.
It's exciting for me, too, to be here. It's fun to move out of my little town, because I show there all the time, and I have a big following there, but that's like family, so it's different. So it's nice to have a little bit more wider, audience.
And do you enjoy the interaction with the public when people are coming to view your art?
I
realize sometimes artists are like, oh, it's sort of hide or whatever. But,
I kind of...
You're on display.
I know. I'm used to it now, after all these years. But I do enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when I come to here, because I have a lot of friends here. And I actually have a whole group of friends that are coming in from Petersburg, too. So we're going to be a good group.
So for we've got just a minute here before we have to go. But for people who maybe are not familiar with your art, anything you would say to them to pique their curiosity and interest to maybe come on down and take a look?
Well, being living in Petersburg, it is. I feel like my art is Scandinavian, has a little bit of that in there. So I think that might be a little bit of. I don't know if some people like that, maybe. And I will be there and be very happy to meet people and get some color in.
Mm-hmm. And Colleen, just real briefly, anything to add to that in terms of getting people to come in?
Well, it'll be 4:30 to 7 at Annie Kills, 244 Front Street, downtown.
Very good. Sorry to run out of time. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Doug.